Welcome to the Furled Sails Sailing Podcast. This is show number 68, Reese Pally. Today is the 17th of December, 2006.
Welcome to Furled Sails, the world's first sailing podcast. Our show notes are located at www.furledsails.com. Well, this week we talked to Reese Pally, who is an author and a sailor and an all-around great guy. We really enjoyed talking to him.
Yeah, we had a really good time talking to him.
He was fun. He's 85 years old, and boy, what a character.
It's fun talking to him. So yeah. Here's the interview.
My name is Reese Pally. I'm 85 years old. I've been sailing since I was 35. I'm a writer, and I gave up my earlier businesses in about 1979, had a sailboat built by Ted Brewer, and for the next 20 years, we sailed around the world.
Right.
Okay.
That's a pretty good introduction.
It's a great introduction. So how did you get started sailing?
Oh, I was just a fat merchant on the boardwalk, and I needed some way to get away from the pressures and from the complications. And I bought a little 23-foot runabout and sailed in the Back Bay in Atlantic City for a whole year with my jib sheeted to windward. That's how little I knew about about sailing a boat. And I was too proud to ask.
So no lessons?
No, never took a lesson. I think sailing schools are terrible. They don't do anything except discourage you from learning the way you have to learn, which is by sailing. Skill of sailing is in the muscles of your body. Very little of it is in your head. Much of it is in the muscular response to the boat.
Okay.
So what finally made you unsheet your jib?
Finally figured it out. I wasn't going anywhere. And I think what happened was I took a look at some movies or whatever it was I saw, or I was watching other boats go by, and I realized that the jib belonged on the other side of the boat. Mm-hmm. Taught me a lot about foresails, I'll tell you that.
Well, you're making me feel much better. Well, because I've learned the same way. You know, I never took any instruction. I went out once with a friend's boat, and they put the sails up, put the autopilot on, kicked back on the foredeck, and said, "Now this is sailing." That was my instruction.
I used to teach for one summer. I taught sailing. It was in New England somewhere, and my method was, I was at one end of the boat. The guy was at the other. I gave him one instructions, and I went to sleep. The instruction was, "Where is the wind coming from?" And that's all you have to know. Once you figure that out, you can figure everything else out yourself. And it worked. Turned out a bunch of nice sailors.
Okay. I bet it does. And I think you're absolutely right. I think that you can read all the books you want, and if you never go out there and do it, you'll never figure it out. And it's not nearly as hard as people think it is.
No, listen, think of all the dumb sailors you've ever known. It's not hard at all. It's a matter of doing it, accepting what little discomfort and challenge the sea throws at you, and eventually do it the right way, which is to cross an ocean.
Okay.
Now, you said you're a merchant, but you were selling art, right?
Broadly speaking, it was art. We had several galleries around the country, and one in Paris. I had them for about 25 years, and then in 79... circumstances decided for me that I should get out, and that's when my life took a very lovely change.
Okay. What made you make that decision?
I made a lot of money.
Well, that's one way to go.
That's what happens when you suddenly come into a lot more money than you ever thought you'd ever have. And you realized that you'd been 20 years in the same business, and that was really enough. And I'd always sailed up till that point, and had a 32-footer built, and did cross the Atlantic with absolutely no knowledge of anything. and learned an enormous amount doing that sail. And by the time we sailed back by way of the southern route, I already knew what sailing was all about.
Okay. I love it. So the boat you took across the Atlantic the first time, was that unlikely?
No. Well, yeah, it was unlikely one.
Okay.
It was a 32-foot west sail, which I got to tell you, will tack easily between 180 degrees, if you're lucky, and will absolutely save your life time and time again if you don't know what you're doing. It's slow and it's steady and it just knows what it wants to do and it doesn't let you make mistakes. So that was my teacher. My teacher was a boat. And it was a slow and untender boat that was built for very rough handling.
Why did you name your boat Unlikely?
Well, fat Jewish merchant 1,000 miles from shore is pretty damned unlikely.
Yes, I believe it is. You're right. Do you own a boat currently?
We just last year, we finally gave on the seventh unlikely to the Maritime Museum in Connecticut, Mystic. Was at 85. The boat was built for ocean crossings. It was 6 foot long keel, 6 foot 6 foot depth. It drew 6 foot, and it was clear that although I feel pretty good and I get around okay, and I still sail on OPB, which is other people's boats, I was not going to do another ocean crossing.
Okay.
We gave it away, and it was a bad moment and a good moment. And it was a great sense of relief because I could never stand having my boat not be up to snuff. So it meant a lot of work and a lot of activity and a lot of cleaning and a lot of doing. And after a while, it interfered. Because I was not using the boat, it interfered with my current work.
Right.
Sure. Now, why do you think you've been so active late in life as opposed to your earlier?
Well, I was always active, but the question you should ask is why at 50 did I decide to take off on a strenuous activity? And the answer is very clear. I don't know. It just happened. I mean, I never planned to sail around the world. I loved having a boat that would cross an ocean. When we got the first unlikely, the 32-foot west sail, we just kind of played at it for a while. And one day we just took off from North Carolina and headed to Bermuda, and we got there. Having arrived in Bermuda, we thought it was a damn good idea to go on to the Azores. And from then on, the sea just led year-round. We sailed down the coast of Africa and back what is called the Ladies Route to the Caribbean, and pulled up in Miami and had Ted Brewer design us a boat, took a year to build. And when we got that boat, we just said, well, we got this big boat and it's built for the ocean, so let's go. So we headed out through the Panama Canal and we were 40 days at sea until we got to the Society Islands. Hivaoa was the first landfall we made. Incidentally, there is absolutely nothing in the world, nothing, I mean food, money, or sex, that begins to approach your first landfall, or any landfall after you've been a long time at sea. There's a special bittersweet quality about having reached your destination and seeing it rise out of the sea on one hand, and the sign of a sadness that you're leaving the sea and getting back onto the land. I think Matissier wrote about that very eloquently.
Okay.
And demonstrated it in his race.
And exactly. I love that man. Fuck him, he said. And you can edit that out.
No, we don't need to. But, yeah, and kept sailing. I love that. I really did. What do you think has kept you so active?
Well, I think the majority of it are genes. I think, and this is something I've been thinking about pretty long. I was never a jock when I was very young. So I did not abuse my body. And what happens to jocks, to people who play contact sports and things like that, is that they develop small difficulties in their early age, which they brush off. But by the time you're 50 or 60, they come back and whack you in the ass. So I think some of it is due to the fact that I never abused myself in my youth. And the other is genes. You have to be lucky with genes, you know.
Right.
I think you're right about that.
A great lottery in the sky, you know. what you're going to get. And given good genes, you're obligated to treat them well.
And I must say, I've seen your pictures and pictures of you and Marilyn, and you both look wonderful.
Well, we are.
I would never have guessed that you were 85.
Yeah, well, that's because in the past 10 years, my wife, who is a yoga nut and a health nut, she's actually a health terrorist, and she teaches water aerobics, and she's just as beautiful today as she was when she was 20, more so, she says, just keeps me active. I mean, she pushes me, impresses me, watches my diet, sees to it that, you know, I get the proper amount of exercise. We're in the pool every day when we're in Key West, and we do an hour every day of water aerobics. And when we're up here, I kind of miss it, and I fall back a little bit. But a lot of the fact that that things are going well physically is because she kept me moving.
Sure.
That when you're over 60, how old are you guys?
38 and 39.
Oh, well, you're children. But when you're over 60, it's so easy not to move. And one of the things that contributed to how I feel now is that at 50, I took off for the sea. And I had 20 really heavy physical years between 20 and 70 when my body was kept tuned. Just about that time, I had a heart attack and dropped some weight and have been fine for the past 10 or 15, 10, 12 years.
How long have you and Marilyn been married?
We've been together for 33 years.
That's wonderful.
During which I've had two other wives.
You've had two other wives during the 33 years?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
But the first one predated her, so that didn't count. The second one was a very short-lived affair.
Oh, okay.
And Mara and I just kept coming together over the years. Not coming together from apart. I mean, we just worked together no matter who I was involved with or what wives I had wandering around or where I was. Marilyn was, but I orbited around that woman. She's my son and I'm the moon.
Now, what older sailors have you met that have stayed with you?
Oh, of course, you know how my memory's going. He wrote books called Impossible Journey and things like that. One-legged sailor, do you remember who I'm talking about? He was his own worst enemy. He wrote a lot of books, and he desperately tried to make money on them and couldn't, and was mad at he's a Welshman. And he wrote these books, which are supposed to be true reports of the great, wonderful things he did, and they were sometimes true, but sometimes not. But he wrote a whole series of books that were very popular. I can't remember his name. Let me tell you a little story about him. We were in Rhodes. Do you know Rhodes Harbor?
Mm-hmm.
It's a fairly small harbor with a very narrow entrance. It's where the Colossus of Rhodes used to supposedly stood. And he was there with a boat called Outward Leg. That was where he had lost one of his legs and was sailing this little catamaran with a young man. And there were a million boats in the harbor. If you've ever been in Rhodes in the summertime, they're five deep in every spot. He was taking off for one of his legs, one of his passages, And we just thought it would be great if we had just would see him off. And I went around, and a couple of my friends went around to all the boats and said, when blank leaves, God, I can't remember that name.
Jones?
Jones, Tristram. Tristram Jones. Yeah, Tristram Jones. When Tristram was taking off, we thought it would be just great to give him a really big send-off. So we alerted everybody in the, there must have been 1,000 boats, big steamers and ferry boats and a million yachts. And we said that when Tristan gets to the entrance, it's a wonderful narrow little entrance, he said, let's give him a big roaring salute. Every whistle, every bell, every siren in the harbor was to go off. Tristan takes off, waves goodbye to everybody, and just as he gets to the entrance, the whole island goes up in smoke. Just everything rang and blew, and it was the most dramatic moment that you could ever imagine. And he enters this narrow entrance, and he gets caught on something. He goes aground. Well, now, that's not the end of the story, because Tris Jones was, if nothing, a man of great imagination. So he sent his young man, no, he went overboard, actually, to see what it was. It was probably, I don't know, a chain or something like that they caught. And he comes up in a few minutes with a wrapped bundle. And he says, I have found the thumb of the Colossus. So that was the way his stories went. He turned great embarrassment into a great victory. And off he went. Yeah, Tris Jones was. My hero is a man by the name of Marvin Creamer. Does that name ring a bell?
No.
No, sure doesn't.
It should. Marvin was a school teacher in South Jersey. He retired a long time ago. And one day, he taught geography. And one day, hi, honey, my wife just walked in. Very nice. But stick around, I'm doing the interview, and I forget some stuff. One day he simply decided that he wanted to sail around the world. He didn't have a boat. He never knew. He had never been on a boat before. He had never sailed anywhere. And he wanted to sail around the world, and he wanted to do it without any electronics. And he wanted to do it without a compass. And he wanted to do it without a watch. And he wanted to do it without a sextant.
Okay.
He wanted to do it just by the stars and his eyes. Marvin set out from New Jersey. A year later, he comes back. He did the circumnavigation in less than a year without any instrumentation at all. No compass, no watch, no sextant, no electronics, no logs, nothing. Just his knowledge of the stars and his ability. As he said, oh, it's easy to know when a star transits. You just look straight up. And that to me, is one of the great, great passages. And he has not been recognized for it.
Wow.
I just love the sheer gumption of it.
Yeah, okay. The other hero in my book is a man by the name of Don Cohan. And the other is Sir Humphrey Barton. I'll tell you about both of them. Don Cohan is a very successful, I don't know if he's a lawyer, an engineer, or a developer, whatever, an extremely successful man who had never been to sea, decided that sailing, that racing sailing was his cup of tea. And he at various times had all kinds of physical things wrong with him. You might want to talk to him, too. He's a terrific guy.
Okay.
Cancer in the head and all kinds of terrible things. After which, he would come back to the sea all the time and win firsts in the Olympics. Don Cohan, C-O-H-A-N. Let me tell you why he's my hero. I was puddling around with my little boat and a little outboard motor out behind Atlantic City and running aground and having all kinds of trouble. And I look up and I see a half-scale America's Cup boat. Have you ever seen one?
Right. Mm-hmm. I've seen a picture of one.
They're just wonderful. They're so beautiful. And they're just half-scale, half the size. Silently come in through a very difficult entrance at Egg Harbor. And bring the boat in through all the traffic and come up to the dock, turn around, head up into the wind, and nestle up against the dock. And I just had to find out about that boat. And there was Don Cohan without a motor and just handling this boat as if he had 300 horsepower underneath him. It was an event to watch. And that taught me a lot about two things, about sailing without a motor and how to come into to land. The other one, is Humphrey Barton. Do you know who Humphrey Barton is? Commodore of the Ocean Cruising Club. The Ocean Cruising Club is an English club of sailors. It's the only one worth belonging to, because to belong to it, you to be a member of the Ocean Cruising Club, you have to have done 1,000 miles point to point at sea. In other words, it's not a tyro sailor. It's for people who have been out there and done it. My first sailing adventures, if you want to call them that, were in the Sir Francis Drake Strait down in the islands.
Uh-huh.
You know where that is, in the Virgins. And I had chartered a boat there, and we were out there in this 9 mile long place, just feeling saltier than a Bismarck herring. And I was feeling just great. And I finally pulled in it in the evening to a crowded harbor, and with much huffing and puffing and chugging about and bumping up against boats and running aground and yelling, and there was a great deal of screaming taking place, and we finally get the hook down. Of course, it dragged, and we had to come back up and fix it, and it was one of the least elegant moments that anyone can ever imagine. I terrified the entire harbor. Just didn't know what we were doing, and we were doing it fast, and we were doing it with a lot of... Anyway, we got settled in, and a little 24-footer, 26-footer, 27-footer, called the Mary Rose, I remember, suddenly appears at the mouth of the harbor with only one little old man at the helm. And he sails in very quietly, no motor, no nothing, threads his way around through all the ships and all the places, finds a place to drop his hook, pulls the boat around, and without any help, heads up into the wind, crawls forward, because he was a very old man, drops his hook, lets the boat fall back, and then he goes down, he disappears down below, and we don't see him for 4 or 5 hours. I decided that this is a guy I had to know. So I rode over after he appeared again, and it turned out to be Sir Humphrey Barton, who was, as I tell you now, was the head of the Ocean Cruising Club, with this wonderful little boat, the Mary Rose. His wife was with him, and she had stayed below the whole time, didn't offer to help or anything. It wasn't needed. And I learned again my same lesson. The same lesson was that when you come into port, you just shouldn't have to depend on a motor. You should do everything slow. And that what that little old 70 or 80-year-old guy can do, anybody can do. So those are my heroes, the people who do things quietly.
Right.
And don't race boats. Except for Don Cohan. I forgive him anything.
In Call of the Ancient Mariner?
Yeah?
Why the chapter on sex?
Well, isn't that the central interest of most people in the world? Huh? I mean, why not? Besides it.
We have 4 kids, so I guess it must be.
At least 4 times in your life it was. Sailing's a very sexy business. Very sexy at one point, because sailors are, you know, they're who they are. They're the independent ones, they're the free ones, and they're attractive, both the men and the women. But the problem with sex on the sailboat is that it's so furiously uncomfortable that you've got to concentrate.
That's true. Who is Bill Pinkney?
Ah, another great story. Did you read about him?
I haven't actually read Call of the Ancient Mariner. It's on my list.
I don't know. There's a better book for you to read.
Okay.
The best book was There Be No Dragons. The book that would be most interesting to you guys is something called Unlikely People.
Okay.
Which are brief stories about unbelievable people. Okay, Bill Pinkney?
Uh-huh.
Bill Pinkney grew up in Chicago. He had never been to sea. He was poor. He was black. And he was Jewish. And if you can imagine anything worse than that, I can't. Bill, at one point, decided he wanted to sail around the world. And he had no skills and no training, and not only that, but he wanted to do it solo. Bill managed to hustle a sailboat, a very famous sailboat. I've forgotten whose it was. It was somebody who had done a circumnavigation in the boat. Anyway, he borrowed the boat, shows up in Philadelphia. The boat is now up on up being finished and being made ready, being fitted out for the sea, and somehow or other he reaches my son, and my son calls me, and we go down to see Bill Pinkney. We met Bill, who is wonderful, but totally, totally unprepared for the project that he was setting out. I mean, solo. And we helped him as best we could, and the boat was ill-prepared, and he was impatient. And, of course, he took off alone on the beginning of this circumnavigation that he absolutely had to do. When we waved goodbye to him on the dock and he sailed down the Delaware, we thought we'd never see him again. About a year later, Bill pops up, or 2 years later, I don't know how long. He had done his solo circumnavigation, and he was back in America.
Huh.
And I got to tell you, a guy with all those strikes against him, you know, everything was wrong. Everything was wrong. But that's almost the way sailors are, you know?
Sure.
The sailors that grow up in sailing families tend to be racers. The guys who just fall into it, like in the midlife crisis or something like that, tend to be the ones that go around the world or cross oceans or do all the strange things that some guys do.
Sure. What's your favorite story from Unlikely People?
Willie. W-I-L-L-I-E. No question about it. It's one of the great stories of all time.
And what is it?
Oh, I'm not going to tell you. I'll let you read it.
Okay.
Are there any stories you wish you'd put in the book, Unlikely People, that you weren't able to?
No, there were 50. I think there are 50 stories in the book.
Okay.
And they were the ones that stayed with me, you know, that I remembered from at that point, about 10 or 15 years at sea. And they are, the book is broken down into funny people, sad people, lucky people, unlucky people, you know, these categories of people. Four or five categories, and they are really wonderful stories, and I claim no honor in reporting them because they're true. It's just a matter of my reporting the stories and describing these very unlikely people.
Okay.
What made you write There Be No Dragons, and what's it about?
There Be No Dragons was written for women and was written not specifically for women, but was written in response to the endless stories that you hear from sailors that their wives won't sail with them because they don't want to be at sea, they're afraid. And it was written for the other class of people, that is men, who don't go to sea because they think the sea is dangerous. And the argument behind There Be No Dragons is that, well, let me tell you, the Portuguese sailors of the 15th century, have you ever seen any of the maps I drew? Wonderful, wonderful, gilded, gold, heavily blues, and all decorated with dragons and everything else. And anyway, where they sailed, they would fill in the outlines of the seas and the coastlines. Where they haven't been to, they would draw a dotted line, and they would say, "Beyond here, there be dragons." So my argument was there be no dragons.
I like it.
There are no dangers at sea. The dangers at sea are the ones you make yourself. But the book deals with things that keep people away from the sea. Okay, what are they? What is the most important, most effective thing, fear, that people have of the sea that keeps them from going sailing? You want to answer me that?
I guess storms.
Nah.
Sharks?
Seasickness.
Really?
Yeah. People go onto a boat, get seasick, and never get back on a boat again.
Ah, right.
And it's seasickness that keeps people away from the sea, more than anything else. And my argument is simple. You've been to sea. Once you're there for 2 days or 2.5 days, you suddenly wake up one morning and all the sickness is gone, and you're feeling wonderful and to the world. It's known as a sea change. And everything just changes after 2 days. So you just have to put up with 2 or 3 days of being miserable, stinking, vomiting, seasick, and then suddenly the world changes. But nobody invests, or very few people invest those 2 or 3 days.
I'm one of those blessed people. I've never gotten seasick.
Me either.
Well, then you must have an inner ear problem.
Yeah, probably do. Probably do.
Oh, we were talking about things to be not to be afraid of at sea. You mentioned storms, right?
Yep.
We never ran into a major storm in 20 years. And it's very simple. You only cross the Atlantic going to Europe in June, and you only cross the Atlantic coming back from Europe in January. No hurricanes, no bad seas, for the ladies' route, as I said. So that if you want to sail in the Atlantic, all you have to do is that, and you'll never run into a storm. You can run into bad weather. You can run into a gale. You can run to 35, 40 knots. But that's not going to threaten the boat.
Right.
Storms are supposed to be able to sink boats. Well, they can't sink a sailboat. Even hurricanes, as you know, there are endless stories of people who survived them. But it's not a matter of survival, it's a matter of enjoying them. And you never have to sail where there is a storm. And you never sail in the Pacific during hurricane and typhoon times. Other than that, the Pacific is a pussycat. What else did you mention as people are afraid of?
I said sharks, but...
Well, that's silly, because you're never in the water.
Yeah, that's true.
And if you're in the water, they're afraid of you anyway. So, no, sharks are not a taller threat.
Recently, we had an interview with a gentleman who studied flotsam, and now I'm afraid of big containers and timbers that have fallen off ships.
Okay, I was going to talk about that. There is in theoretically, a number of these containers that have fallen off ships, okay? They are so minute in terms of the enormity of the ocean that the chances of you running across them are much, a thousandth less than being struck by lightning.
Right.
Sure.
So but there are things which you can generate as fears, but aren't really real fears.
Sure.
It's not as dangerous as driving.
But the one real fear, the one real fear which you can avoid, it's hard to avoid, but which you can't do much about, is a whale. Now, whales... you just don't sail near a whale. That's it. In the daytime, you can see them, so you can avoid them like the plague. At night, you can smell them. When they blow, the air that comes out of them is just so powerfully salty that you can actually locate where they are, in what direction. So one of the dangers that you can't do much about, I'm saying the book is broken down into things you should be afraid of, things you shouldn't be afraid of, things you can do something about, and things you can't do anything about.
Sure.
And the things you can't do anything about, I think, are just reduced to whales, except to try to avoid them. But whatever fear you can think, getting lost, everybody's afraid of getting lost, right?
I don't know. I don't think that's one of my fears.
I'm a Gulf of Mexico sailor. I just kind of got to head north, east, or west. And
that's all you have to do anywhere in the world is just head west. There's no way to get lost. I mean, I worked out a system. If you know your pulse rate and you have a chip of wood, you can estimate to within a tenth of a knot your speed. So you don't even need a watch to get your speed. If you know anything at all about where the sun rises or sunsets, you can always tell which way west is. And this is the way the old sailors did it. They'd sail down to the latitude line they want and head down that latitude line.
Right.
So there's just no way of getting lost.
Okay.
The big danger, of course, is to approach a coast. I mean, that really takes a great deal of thought and care and consideration, because the coasts are where the problems are.
Sure.
So you always make port just before sunrise. Because before sunrise, you can still see the lights. And that way you can find your direction. And as the sun comes up, the lights will have led you into the contours of the land. At that point, you shut off your motor and sail in.
Okay. Thomas Hoyne, the Grand Banks fishing schooners.
Right.
Who's Thomas Hoyne?
Thomas Hoyne was an illustrator for advertising agencies in Chicago. When he was a landbound guy, and when he was about 40, 45, he was diagnosed with terminal cancer and given 2 years to live. At that point, being a very sensible man, he quit his job and started doing the things that he obviously loved all of his life, was to paint sailboats, sailing vessels, in a very special situation, a very special condition. He painted only fishing vessels, nope, without power, who were fishing on the Grand Banks. Now, you know the Grand Banks, you know that's the worst place in the world to be, summer or winter.
Right.
They fished by landlines, hand-fished by landlines out of 12-foot dories, endless fogs, just terrible, terrible weather.
Yep.
And these were the sailors that he respected. And in the course of the next 17 years, because he outlived the 2 years prediction, he painted 100 paintings, and then he died of something else. The problem with Tom Hoyne was that he had been essentially forgotten. He had never had a show, his paintings were scattered all over the world, and of course 100 paintings doesn't make a body of work. You know, you need 1,000 paintings to make a body of work. So he was gradually forgotten about, and one day when I was doing a book called The Best of Nautical Quarterly, you know the magazine Nautical Quarterly? This one doesn't exist anymore. It went out of business in the 80s, or 90s, I don't know when.
Well, if it was 80s, we were still in high school.
Then get on eBay, or get on a place called ABE Books. Do you know that? ABE Books. And put in Nautical Quarterly, and you will find copies of it that come up.
Okay.
It was a hardbound book, the most elegantly conceived sailing book that was ever written. It was edited by a man who had no financial pressures, because he had one of the big publishers was backed the book, and he had the delightful job of producing every month, every quarter, for a year, for 20 years, this wonderful book. He paid very well, so he got the best of the writers, the best of the photographers, and it is a brilliant collection of 49 books. Anyway, I wrote for that just before they went out of business. I hope it wasn't because I wrote for them that they went out of business. But I loved Gribbins, was his name, the editor, and I loved him because he knew how to treat writers and he knew how to treat artists. And time went by, and I just was always sad that magazine and continued. And one day I got the great idea to write a book called The Best of Nautical Quarterly. And all we did was, out of the 50 issues, we chose 18 articles and replicated them from the original material, because there was no, you know, there were no negatives or pictures or nothing was left except the printed page.
Right.
But we figured out a way to produce from the printed page, and turned out a wonderful little volume called The Best of Nautical Quarterly. Anyway, one of those books, one of those articles, was an article on art by Thomas Hoyne. And I was captivated by it. And I don't like realist, I don't think realist paintings are, you know, are central to the way we think about art today. But because I'm a sailor, and because I have this enormous respect for working sailors, especially people who sail without motors, as you can see, that's a recurring theme.
Sure.
I decided that I was going to rescue this man from the grave. So I had the luck to get in touch with his widow, Dory, and the rest is a small piece of literary history. We finally located reproductions of the actual paintings of every painting he ever did, which took me 2 years. Mounted, I curated a show at a Maritime Museum, the first show that's ever been shown of his work. And the book which came out was called Wooden Ships and Iron Men, The Maritime Art of Thomas Hoyne. And if you haven't seen the book, you should. It's a wonderful book. But probably better than that is the book called The Best of Nautical Quarterly.
Okay.
Because that'll give you a survey of the best writing and the best photography and the best of everything.
Now, you wrote two of those, right?
I wrote both of them. That is The Best of Nautical Quarterly, and it was from that my interest in Thomas Hoyne grew.
Okay.
Now, what do you mean when you say doing your life rather than viewing your life?
Don't think that needs much explication, does it?
Well, maybe we're slow.
Viewing your life, I think it has, I don't even recall the quote, but I know what it means. It means that that people are endlessly concerned with what they've accomplished in their life and whether they're living up to their own expectations. And screw expectations, you know. You either sit around either reaching or not reaching your expectations, but nobody ever does, or you go out and you do it. It's just a matter of living your life.
Okay.
I don't know if that's terribly profound. I think it's pretty self-evident.
It works for us.
And you know.
What's the strangest thing you've ever found on a boat?
On a boat or?
In a boat.
In a boat, on a boat, or a place where a boat is or something?
Sure.
An event or a thing?
Doesn't matter.
Yeah, we had left Japan and we were sailing toward Shanghai. And we were incidentally the first sailing vessel ever to come, private sailing vessel ever to come into Shanghai port, a Western sailboat after the war.
Oh.
I think it was around 82. And we had left the Philippines and we sailed across the South China Sea. And suddenly we knew we were near the mouth of the Yangtze. But the mouth of the Yangtze is tens of miles wide,
mm-hmm.
maybe 100, maybe more. And we knew approximately where we were. And suddenly, just ahead of us, the sea, which had been blue and calm, was a bright yellow. And the difference between the blue and the yellow was a line drawn as if by a ruler.
Wow.
And that was the silt of the Yellow Sea. The Yangtze is indeed yellow, but to see it so demarcated that you sail out of blue water across a line and you're in yellow water was one of the strangest feelings I've ever seen.
Oh, that sounds cool.
That's cool.
You can still do it. It's still yellow.
We'll have to do it.
So what is your favorite sailing story?
The favorite sailing story, I won't tell it because it's a long one. We were dismasted in the Red Sea. And we ran to the coast of Ethiopia. And to make a very long story short, we were finally accosted by the local, it was communist at that time, by local fishermen and then local gun-toting natives. And they were, we had a broken mast, right? And we were told to that a gunboat would come the next day and escort us down to the capital port. I was sailing buddy with another sailor of mine, another sailor friend, who, great story. I should really mention that. And anyway, we knew that night was the last night we'd be free or ever retain our boats, because once the Ethiopians got a hold of them, we'd either end up in jail and the boats would certainly disappear. So it was a moonless night. And I had no radar, but my friend had radar. And we started creeping out of this little harbor. And suddenly I hear a soft call from my friend on the other boat and informs us there are 5 gunboats lurking around the mouth of the harbor.
Ah!
Well, what happened was, we were under power at the time. What happened was that these gunboats were looking for us and there to find us. We could see them. They could not see us. We had radar. They did not. And we spent an hour dodging back and forth, literally avoiding them the way you would avoid people in a dark room. And all they had to do was turn off their motors and listen, and they would have found us. And they didn't. And we got past them. And we put up our jury-rigged sails because I had lost the top 2/3 of my mast. And we sailed down to Djibouti, 500 miles down to Djibouti, and we got away from the bad Ethiopians.
Oh, my.
That was a major adventure. It was written about in a couple of magazines.
Wow.
My friend, there's a story in one of those books, which I won't repeat to you. It's a story, and it's another great friend of mine. I mean, a great sailor who happens to be a friend of mine, who was, and the name of the story is The Sailor Who Talks to God. Well, a lot of people talk to God, but very, very few people have God talk back to them. And with this young man, he spoke to God, and God spoke back to him, giving him all kinds of instructions. The instructions that he was given, he was a South African, was that God said to him one day, the Jews of South Africa are in trouble, and you've got to save the Jews. And my friend asks, how is he going to save the Jews? And God said to him, that's for you to figure out. And to make a very long story short, what he did was, he designed a boat that was specifically built to take all the worldly goods, an automobile, a sailboat, it was about 46-footer. And this boat was to be the prototype for the boats that would allow the Jews of South Africa to escape. He was my partner, and the adventures that we had with him were just wonderful. But he actually spoke to God, and God spoke back.
Okay.
But that story, which I told badly, is in one of the books. It's called The Sailor That Speaks to God.
Okay.
That you should read. Actually, you should read religiously every word I've ever written.
We will.
We will do that. We both read a whole bunch, so that won't be a task or chore.
The name of the title was, I was in the harbor in Israel, and this strange boat, and it was a very strange boat because it was built from the inside out to accommodate boats. It was to accommodate a car and the furniture and everything that a man wanted to escape with. And it was designed with a hollow keel so that they could pour gold into the keel. Instead of using lead in the keel, he proposed that they use gold,
okay,
which was another way of getting value out of South Africa at the time.
Sure. Are there any questions that we didn't ask you that you wish we had asked?
2,000 or 3,000
Oh, well.
But that's your job, my dear.
Yes. Now, how can people find your books and your website?
Amazon. They're all on Amazon. And they're in, you know, any bookstore will order them for you.
Okay.
But the best is Amazon because they get them right. You know, they're all listed and everything is right there and they give you a discount.
Okay. And your website is just www.reesepally.com?
Yep.
All right. Now, here's a question. The person who suggested we interview you named his baby after you.
It's a very embarrassing story. But the people who named the baby after me did very well because the name Reese is a great name for a man. It's unusual enough that you don't see yourself coming and going, and it always generates curiosity.
Sure.
So that story came to me by accident, because I didn't plan this thing. I didn't follow the child and say, you must name him after me.
Sure.
And every Christmas I get photographs of the young family.
Oh, that's great.
With young Reese. It's a very interesting thing because I'm Jewish, and you're not allowed to name your children after living relatives. I don't know if you knew that.
I did not know that.
So that none of my children could be named after me, but somebody else could name the child after me.
So there you go.
Made my life perfect.
Well, thanks so much for talking to us.
Not at all, my dear, my darling.
We want to thank Reese for giving us the time and letting us talk to him. We had a great time, and he's a very interesting guy, and I'm going to read all his books. They sound great. Now, who do we hear from this week, Christy?
Well, this week we heard from Robert, and he says, Dear Noel and Christy, I especially enjoyed your last two podcasts, the interviews with Pete Goss and with Curtis Ebbesmeyer. If you want to offer your listeners a follow-up on what happens with plastic in the oceans, direct them to the BBC Radio 4 program Coasting the Earth at http://www.bbc.co.uk/radio4.
We'll put that in the show notes.
And we will put that in the show notes. The program from 8th of December 2006, titled Mermaid's Tears, is on what plastic does when it breaks down in the water. The program Scraping the Seabed from 8th of April 2004 should also be interesting to those who take an interest in the environment we sail in. It specifically reports on what dredging does to the British coastline, but the issue should be relevant to other coasts as well. We'll have to check that out. Thanks so much, Robert.
Thank you, Robert.
Next, we hear from Tim, and he says, Noel, I've been a long-time listener to the podcast, and I've not only enjoyed what you've done, but how you continue to migrate the show content so it is interesting and enjoyable. Thanks for your hard work and the pivotal place that you hold in the sailing community. We are in the middle of hunting season, and I would assume that the pictures in the podcast is you. You look like one of our hunters. How about a Hawaiian shirt and baseball cap or any wardrobe change? Ha ha, you don't look too happy. Keep up the good work, Tim.
Okay, let me tell you the story of the orange cap photo. One, I live in Florida. The only long sleeve shirt I own, I wear to church.
Yeah, pretty much.
The only cold weather cap I have is orange for hunting. Mm. Not that I've been hunting lately, but it's the only war cap I have, so I'm out there in the cap because it was cold out that day. I was sick and I was feeling really bad, but I liked the picture, so I've used it anyway.
But we do need an updated picture.
And the photo I replaced was the one, the previous photo to the orange cap photo, I thought of as Fat Man Sailing. And I liked it enough to put it up because it was kind of an action thing, you know, because the boat's heeled over and you can see me with my feet braced and you can see how incredibly fat I am. Okay, that part was the negative. But then after that, I lost 50 pounds. And so I looked up the site one day and I said, oh my God, I was so fat. And so I took it down and I put the orange cap picture up. Not that I was really that much thinner in the orange cap picture, but you couldn't tell. And I need a new picture.
Yep.
So I'm going to work on that.
Thanks, Tim.
Also want to thank Tim. He gave me a whole bunch of suggestions for the website, one of which I've already implemented. The others I would have implemented if I hadn't been so lazy this week. Okay, busy this week. But the one thing I did is over on the right-hand side of the page, instead of it saying show one, oh, it doesn't say show one, show four, show five, etc., all the way up to show number whatever, I changed those to the subject of the show. And I think it'll be much easier to find what you're looking for if you want to look at an old show than it was before.
Right.
I have this page about half done that has it all organized by the name of the person we interviewed and the subject and all this. But this was a real quick way to change that right-hand column from something perhaps not so useful to something very useful.
Yep.
Other things are, you know, a list of the recipes we've done and books we've reviewed and things like that. And I'm working on that. Well, I want to thank Tim because he gave me a great idea and some other great ideas that I'm going to implement real soon now.
Okay.
I've been exchanging email with Bruce, and I feel a little bad because Bruce wrote in and said he couldn't download show 48, and it looked fine to me, and I could get it. And so I sent him an email that said, looks good to me, and I think he sent me one back that I missed. And then he just recently sent me another one that said he still couldn't get 48. Well, I haven't been really able to figure out why he can't get show 48. It's been downloaded about the same number as other shows, but I don't doubt him. I mean, I think there's just some subtle problem. So if anybody's had a similar experience where they could get most of the shows, but they couldn't get this one show, or they've had any other problem like that, we'd love an email about that so that perhaps I can track down why some people are having trouble.
Right. Next, we hear from Chris, and he says, hi, guys, still listening. Congratulations on your continued success with your great podcast. I've just enjoyed listening to your interview with Dr. Curtis Ebesmeyer. Very interesting. I remember hearing a piece in one of your podcasts regarding teak decking. I think the product was an artificial teak, but I can't remember the name of it. Can you help? Thanks again, Chris.
Well, this wasn't easy to find. I had a vague memory about it, too, and I thought it was the Hunter Show, but I thought, I'll just bypass all that. I'll go to Google. I'll find it. Well, I didn't find it. So I went and I listened to the part of the interview where I remembered it was in there, and it was, what, FlexiTeak.
Mm-hmm.
And it's got a website, www.flexiteak.com, and it looked like an interesting product. And I remember being on the boat at the boat show, and it looked just like teak to me.
Right.
But apparently it's some sort of plastic that looks like teak. The Gunner guy, I think, didn't he say they put it on there to lower the maintenance?
Yeah, absolutely.
And it was like the floor or something. What did they use it for? Do you remember?
They used it for the seating and the flooring in the cockpit.
Ah, right, right. So, kind of high wear areas that, you know, if it was real teak, you'd wear the varnish off pretty fast, I think.
Right.
It looks good. I don't have any personal experience on it, but the Hunter guy liked it. And, you know, Hunter builds a lot of boats, so they've got that much of an endorsement.
So we hope that helps you, Chris.
Yep.
Thanks for joining us this week. You can call and leave your comments, stories, or suggestions toll-free at 1-866-235-2786. You can email us at podcast@furledsails.com. And again, the show notes are located at www.furledsails.com. See you on the water.
See you on the water.